That's Segundo here, and this podcast contains part two of our Young Roving Correspondent's conversation with Rupert Thompson. Our Young Roving Correspondent has admonished me for the previous introduction. He is apparently happily attached, and he is not interested in handlebar mustaches, much less British men. I suppose I could apologize for misrepresenting the integrity and character of our Young Roving Correspondent's passion and hard work. Then again, we all need a script kick in the ass from time to time.
Okay, so this is part two. It's a day late and a dollar short or something along those lines. Rupert, I hope thank you very much for meeting for a second day for this.
Another day, another diner.
Exactly. Well, we left off talking about the slender connection between Billy Tyler and Myra Hindley. You were mentioning the hotel populated by salesmen and transitory figures.
Oh, that's
going
where we
through.
Were. Yeah, I remember now.
But I actually wanted to sort of tie this into to elaborate on your answer to the sort of broader thing we were mentioning about bridges in this book and how Billy only seems to be able to, I guess, access the world through these sorts of transitory hubs or these conduits. And I'm wondering, at what point were these sorts of slender bridges, whether they be transitory locations or bridges, did this enter into the revision process where you became, I guess, conscious? Again, we're going into this whole conscious versus unconscious thing, but...
Yeah, we are. I mean, you see, he seemed like a character... There's a lot made of his search for a home, a house to live in, and he... He does kind of fall in love with that place. There's a lot of description around around the house and around the surroundings and this cornfield that he can see out of the window. But you have a sense that everything else is pretty unstable and pretty, as you say, transitory. And also there's a sense in which, as a policeman, I guess the simple fact that they can't have the ordinary social life, they can't drink wherever they like. They kind of have to drink out of the area, you know, if they want to have drinks, because they can't afford to be recognized by anyone who knows what they do for a living. So there's a sense in which they end up in out of the way places anyway, you know, kind of for their own, almost for their own self-protection. I mean, so that they can have a kind of normal life. Their normal life seems to take place in these out of the way places. It wasn't such a big stretch to find him going to those places and to put him in those places.
So really it was more a kind of a pragmatic form of just exploring where a person who wanted to keep on the load down, you know, on the QT, wanted to actually,
it gets exaggerated because of the fact that he no longer wants to go home, and so he's then looking for places he can go to avoid going home, and, you know, he finds that place by the river.
Yeah.
Where there's a few other people like him knocking about, you know.
Yeah.
As he says, you know, it's not, you don't go down there to make friends. So there's always this sense of isolation, but then strange connections are made in these out-of-the-way places.
Sure. Well, I actually wanted to talk to you about, I guess, since this is also kind of a noirish symbol, the hotel.
Is it what symbol?
It's, in a certain sense, it's kind of a noirish symbol.
The way you think?
To some degree, because he's inhabiting sort of a hotel. There, people sort of go to places and contrive
things. It couldn't be
things.
More bland and characterless, though, and this is what I love about those places.
It could be that, too.
I mean, there's nothing kind of... There's no shadows, you know?
Yeah.
There are no long shadows, really.
But you do have, for example, in the book, this recurrent motif of a woman with a cigarette in a car. That you have, for example, in Trevor's story, the woman with the cigarette.
Well, that's Myra Hindley, of course.
Course. And you have, of course, you know, Myra herself as the sort of, you know, constant sort of smoker.
Yeah.
And this is interesting to me because I'm wondering if noir symbols along these lines are better for you to kind of access this unconscious, dreamlike sort of world of taxonomies, of structures, more so than... I guess non-genre elements. I mean, you know, it's almost as if it's reminiscent in a certain way of like a David Lynch film or a Murakami.
People have said that before. I mean, in fact, they used to say that a lot more in the past than they do now. I mean, David Lynch. I mean, I've been called sort of David Lynch and Prince in the past, and I don't think really that kind of thing is going to come up anymore because I don't feel as if I'm in that territory. In fact, I'm almost disagreeing with you because. Take that hotel scene you're talking about. They're called travel inns in England, and they're a chain. And in fact, because I drove all over the country to research Divided Kingdom, my previous book, and to some extent had to do a lot of research in the UK as well for Death of a Murderer, I always stay. I found myself staying in these places, and I found myself becoming rather addicted to them, precisely because they had no atmosphere whatsoever.
Yeah.
They had no character and no atmosphere, and I loved the kind of the blandness of them. And I thought this. I mean, the book I think is full of juxtapositions like this. In fact, but the juxtaposition of the really bland, ordinary, characterless hotel on a motorway, and then this extraordinary story being told in it. You know, yeah. so you populate. I'm almost perversely choosing ordinary. The locations are almost as ordinary as they can possibly be, and then making something slightly strange happen there.
Yeah.
But the locations themselves, I can't think of one in the book particularly that you know, you could lift from Raymond Chandler, or you could compare to any of those noir writers. I mean,
well, it's certainly not as noirish as Soft, for example.
I would accept that.
Yeah.
You know, that's.
But it seems recurrent. It's interesting to me because there's this recurrent noir imagery in your work, and it just seems to, in your case, really kind of create this sort of, I guess, this grand taxonomy about identity. I mean, and this is also going to tie into another question I had about the fact that the strange reception of this book. People want to call it a crime thriller. People want to call it...
Isn't that laziness?
It is. I mean, like, for example...
It's like niche. Everyone loves to put, well, both things and people in pigeonholes, you know, and I like the fact that the books don't fit into pigeonholes. But yet, in the current literary world, you know, it seems as if more than ever before, people, if things don't fit into those pigeonholes, then you're in a kind of trouble in marketing terms, you know?
Yeah.
Because people don't know exactly what they're dealing with.
It's not just that, though. It's also the fact that people really actually, like, for example, this was reviewed in the New York Times by the mystery columnist Marilyn Stasio.
Yeah. But famous one, is she? Yeah, I mean, apparently, yeah.
Yeah. I have my issues with her, but, you know, but nonetheless, but when she actually, you know, they decided to review this book of yours, the first part of the sentence was, although not in any conventional way a genre novel.
I.e. so, shouldn't be in this column at all.
Exactly. Yeah. So the question is there a certain danger, I guess, in dwelling upon a subject like Myra Hindley? Because people are going to go ahead and label it, oh, well, this must be a true crime.
I just hadn't imagined they were going to do that. I really hadn't. And sometimes in the past, I could understand why. They've tried it all the way along with me at certain points. I mean, with The Insult, for instance, they tried to sell that as a thriller in the UK.
Yeah.
Anyone who wants a thriller is going to be kind of disappointed by The Insult because it doesn't deliver in the kind of obvious ways that thriller writers do. In fact, right from page one of that book, you're going off in a completely different direction to the one you'd normally go in the thriller. In a thriller, having a guy shot in a car park, practically in line one of the novel, normally you'd then find out what that crime was about, you know. Yeah. And of course, this goes completely the other way. And equally with Soft, I mean, that was put in crime sections sometimes. I mean, I didn't really understand. Yeah, it's like if you put Peter Carey's True History of the Kelly Gang in the crime section, because that's got crime in it. I mean, Ned Kelly was a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's no more reason for a book about Murray Hindley to be put in the crime section than there is for one about Ned Kelly. Seems to me.
Yeah. I'm wondering if it's not so much the genre elements as it is the sort of nature of your plots, which are often, you know, like we discussed this in our interview that we did over the phone, of you actually sort of creating, if you were to describe the actual, your novels, they almost sound completely preposterous, like the fact of the United Kingdom being split up into four quarters, or Soft.
I have an American friend who calls this, he teaches fiction writing, and he, in Philadelphia, and he called it the plausibility principle.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
He always has a name for everything.
Yeah.
But there is a sense in which I do that. I take a situation and push it to the very brink of believability, I guess. And then the challenge is to suspend disbelief at that point.
Yeah.
You know. Maybe. Yes. And maybe in that sense, you could say I make things difficult for myself.
Yeah.
You know, because I take as, and sometimes I do feel early on in a book, I think this is kind of. This is ludicrous, what I'm attempting here.
Yeah.
And not just ludicrous, but impossible.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I've taken on something that just isn't going to work.
I'm wondering if you feel there's any sort of limitations on, I guess, you know, if we go too far and if we have a sort of a log line sort of description of your books, people are going to judge and classify your books based exclusively on that log line as opposed to the actual content.
Well, it might be that once people get an idea about the kind of work you do early on, you know, I mean, I was kind of marketed or talked about in in newspapers and magazines in the UK, certainly early on, and I think here as well, as a sort of, yeah, it was all words. The words that were used were words like dark, edgy, hip. You know, it was all that kind of stuff. And I've probably found that a bit difficult to shake off. Yeah. You know, I mean, because I feel like I've moved somewhere completely different now.
Yeah.
And those labels, those words aren't helping me. But I think sometimes the critical establishment can get a fixed idea about what it is that you do, and they don't allow for change. They don't allow for development. Which seems absurd, but it's the only justification that I've got for as to why things have gone the way they've gone. You know.
Yeah. I actually wanted to mention something that James Hines wrote in that Boston Review article. He described the tension between distant. This is him talking. Right. He's describing your prose works and your books work because of the tension between distancing and empathy, and. Again, I'm wondering if this kind of we were talking
distancing
in terms of keeping sort of somewhat removed enough, but then also
not that the characters are removed from normal life, but a different kind of distancing.
I mean, I wanted to ask you about this because I was interested in, I guess, was this a distinction that occurs to you when actually becoming involved in this, or are you so just locking into this visceral unconsciousness that such a distinction or a critical terminology like along these lines actually matters?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I actually think... did I mention judging this prize at the moment that I'm judging, a Barnes & Noble Discover Awards, right?
Yeah,
and
I've got off the record.
And
yeah.
I've got to read 47 novels, and there's this curious notion of judging novels, you know, because it seems to me that it's like comparing a kind of bicycle with a speedboat often. You know, they're going on different journeys, these novels, and they're going at different speeds, and they're different creatures, you know, entirely. And the one criterion that I'm coming down to almost in trying to work out what books are better than others is the empathy part of your question. Is not just empathy, though, it's kind of more like compassion.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is, it sort of ties everything together for me about what I think about fiction, because the reason why I'm not so interested in British fiction is because, I can't remember whether I mentioned this yesterday, but because it has a kind of coldness and cleverness about it, a surface gloss and brilliance often, you know, great style, but there's a kind of insufficiency of emotion, there's a lack of warmth, there's a lack of kind of empathy in there. You know, writers like Martin Amis, who I admire in all kinds of ways, got closest to compassion in his memoir Experience,
yeah.
whereas that's really not evident in the novels. It seems as if he can't really do it in fiction. I would love to see him do it, you know, because that would be fascinating to watch. But, you know, for me, that's my favorite book of his, the non-fiction book. And I think it's almost like maybe that's the reason I'm not as big in the UK as I could be, is because I think my books do go for emotion, and they do deal with those things, and they do have that kind of compassion for the characters. And maybe that's just not fashionable.
Yeah. Maybe it's a matter of the fact that you don't necessarily judge your characters. You simply present their particular experiences.
Not my job judge them.
Whereas Martin Amis, Money is a fantastically funny book, as is The Information. As is Time Zero is interesting, but these are very much grounded in this type of, I guess, judgment, in which no matter how brilliant Martin Amis is, and I happen to think he's a brilliant writer, there is still this tendency of, like, you know, on a base level, wanting, you know, to actually, you have to be along for the ride, you have to judge with the actual characters. I mean, is this perhaps what we may be talking about?
Yeah, no, I prefer to leave the reader more leeway, more room than that. You know, I suppose I don't want to steer them. I just want to lay it out for them to look at, you know, and make up their own minds. I mean, it's curious. I've come to think that that's actually what fiction is about. You know, fiction almost seems to teach compassion if it's really good.
Yeah.
You know, because the very notion of putting yourself in someone else's shoes, in a character's shoes, and learning to kind of identify with them and feel for them. I mean, that's kind of almost the beginning of ethics, you know. It's like,
yeah.
it's like it's like most people are really, really bad at stepping outside themselves and imagining they're someone else in that, in any given situation. Yeah. I mean, my example for this, the best example I can think of is really like a car crash. You know, because a novelist should never be in a car crash.
Yeah.
Because, I have been in a couple, and I always find myself, I can't leap out of the car filled with rage and self-righteous rage about what the other person has done to me. I can always imagine exactly, I can imagine it from their point of view as well.
Yeah.
You know, so I come across, you know, I come up against someone who is absolutely sure of their own ground, i.e. the person I've crashed into.
Yeah.
They're sure of their own ground and they know that they were right and I was wrong. And I'm thinking, well, I may have been right, I may be right about this, but they may be right as well. So therefore I've automatically lost.
But yet there's this deeply visceral motivation towards what you write in terms of the great rush, the nightmares you have.
Hopefully. I mean, you know, I love dynamic, visceral, high-octane prose. You know, sure. I like it to be like that. I like books to feel like that when I read them.
But since, you know, anything approaching the visceral, particularly the deeply visceral, is going to involve, to some degree, a certain amount of judgment, how do you reconcile not judging the circumstances?
Why?
Well, because if you, it's like anger, you know? When you are angry about something, inevitably, you know, your brain is going to be shut off and you're going to immediately make hasty judgments and you're going to sit back and possibly, you know, just, oh, well, I probably jumped the gun here, you know, that basic sort of human quality. You know,
but so, you mean with my characters? With
I guess I'm sort of describing the visceral sort of thrust that guides your writing.
Yeah.
Versus trying to, does the judgment, I guess, come in the rewriting, or do you find that you have a temperament which does not, at least allows you to be visceral without judging in writing these characters?
Yeah, I think I can do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that seems to come naturally, and I mean, I probably said this. Did I say this yesterday? It's so hard to remember what was said when.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, the thing about you know, this kind of strange change that you go through in the process of each novel, the fact that you kind of morph from an intuitive, visceral animal in the first draft and possibly the second draft to a slightly lesser extent, into a kind of cold, ruthless, clear-eyed critic of your own work, you know, in the later stages. And this, I wonder sometimes whether, these are two quite difficult things to balance, you know, and there are writers that are better at one of those than the other, you know, one of those roles than the other. And I guess the trick is to be brilliant at both. But they're very, they're kind of opposite ends of the spectrum, you know, because one is so, one is like operating in a dream and the other is quite the reverse, couldn't be more practical, you know, so you somehow have to encompass both ends of the spectrum with nothing much in the middle, it seems to me. Maybe there's a point I don't know whether there's a point in the third, this is probably examining it too closely, but I mean the point in the fourth or fifth draft where you're sort of you've got a bit of both going on, you know, where the critical eye is beginning to come in but you're still allowing intuition to work, you know, because you never, I mean, you have to leave every manuscript open to change, you know, at every point, I think, even right up to the end.
Just truncating the prose, as we were talking about yesterday, does this actually allow you not to judge the characters, or to allow a sort of scenario where the reader brings his or her judgments possibly to the particular character?
I sort of, probably the challenge is to get the reader to identify with almost all the characters. Mm. I mean, as much as possible. I mean, and they're of course going to be, I mean, in some cases, in the past, I've made that pretty difficult because some of the characters, I mean, these are not characters you'd want to run into yourself, you know, in your own life. You actually wouldn't want them in your life. And yet they somehow seem to be in mine. But, and curiously, kind of, they almost pose threats. You know, they become quite real. In the Five Gates of Hell, you probably haven't read that one. But there's a character called Jed Morgan who I wrote. He actually hijacked that whole novel. That whole novel was supposed to be something else.
Yeah.
Supposed to be very closely based on the experience of my father dying. Now I'm using that novel, ironically, as the basis for my memoir, I don't have any diaries, but I have that novel, and I can use it as a kind of to remind myself of that time that I'm writing about. But what I was going to say was that Jed Morgan actually kind of haunted me, you know, having as a character.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want him in my life at all, but he's sort of he would appear in dreams, and there would be a manila envelope coming through the door. I'd open it, and there'd be pictures of him looking at me.
It's funny you mention him, because Jed and Nathan in The Five Gates of Hell bring... they're like almost like twins. And in fact, there are a lot of twins in Death of a Murderer, I found. I mean, to some degree...
are they?
Yeah, yeah. Well, right. I would say that Trevor and Raymond, because they appear only with Billy. They are almost could be manifestations of his imagination.
Oh, as Myra Hindley is, to some extent.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah.
And
he's a bit like a medium in that sense, I think, in the novel. He's like a sort of... I mean, again, it's a huge juxtaposition, but he's such an ordinary... He's not plodding, exactly, but he's not brilliant. You know, he's a kind of ordinary thinker.
Yeah.
And yet he's thinking about things with such intensity, not depth necessarily, but such intensity that he is sort of summoning ghosts, both from the present, Myra Hindley, and from the past, from his own past, you know. And that's why I think this book would actually make a great play, because, you know, which is how it began. I mean, which is how I conceived of it first. Because it's just people passing through a room, you know, like you keep this, you focus on the stage and the backdrop can shift and change, and these different characters can walk through and inhabit the space for a while and then disappear again.
And yet it's written in third person, so that's why it's interesting to me that
it's a pretty close third person. I mean,
it is. But the thing that's interesting about this particular decision is that, you know, if these are manifestations of his imagination, if we don't necessarily agree with it, well, we're actually looking at this from this sort of third-person prism as opposed to a first-person prism, leaving us to sort of wonder exactly what is possibly true. I mean, because there's a certain authority in using third-person creates a veracity.
There are very different kinds of third-person narratives. I mean, you know, everything from the authorial omnipotence, you know, kind of third-person to really this, which is almost... This is about as close to first-person narration as you can get while still being in the third.
Yeah.
Because everything is filtered through his consciousness, even though it's told in the third person. It's not, you're not getting anyone else's point of view, ever. So you might ask why put it in the third person, but the reason probably is... I think in the first person this would have become much more of an idiomatic novel. I mean, the language would have changed... I do actually, again, you know, this shows how close to the first person it is. I drop in little bits of police speak.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of language that policemen use. So there are phrases like, oh, going down to a club mob-handed, you know, which is something they say in that part of the world, meaning a lot of you at once. And there's various, you know, in probably in 15, 20 places through the novel, there are little idiomatic phrases dropped in to the way he's thinking, just to give you that kind of verisimilitude about the character. But you know, if I'd actually written it in the first person, it would have been a much more slangy book. Because I couldn't really... I didn't want that. I didn't want to use the voice of the policeman. You know, I didn't want it to have that sound. I wanted it to have this kind of... I wanted the prose to be... I actually wanted it to be like what my sister-in-law said the prose in the Book of Revelation was like, but more so. She said she loved the way that book was written because it was like looking through cool, clear water to the dark objects on the bottom. And I wanted this one to be, if anything, even more so, you know, because I think probably the Book of Revelation was slightly richer prose, you know, slightly more imagery in it, slightly more poetic than this is. This is just cleaner all the way through, I think.
But Book of Revelation also has the section of the actual kidnapping in third person. And this is interesting to me. I mean, going back to what we were talking about, Judgment, do you feel that if that were to have been written in first person, or if Billy's story were to have been written in first person, that this would have created a scenario in which you were perhaps more inclined to judge by way of sort of describing that
you
voice?
I'm not sure it's about judgment. I'm not sure I judge characters in whatever person I'm using. Mm-hmm. Because the use of the switch to third person in... wait a minute. It's the other way around in the Book of Revelation.
Yeah, exactly.
It starts off in the third person and then shifts to first person. I think the very good reason that when the character is kidnapped and shackled to the floor in this white room, he's passive, obviously. He's lost all his power.
Yeah.
And this is a situation in which clearly, you know, he's... anyone would be extremely uncomfortable, and anywhere from uncomfortable to terrified. So the use of the third person, and again, it's a very close third person because everything is filtered through his consciousness, but it's coming from the other angle, coming from the opposite direction to Billy, because it's coming from the first person idea, and it's someone who is telling the story, but actually they can't bear to own up to the story. They want to pretend that it's happened to someone else.
Yeah.
They wish it had happened to someone else, and so that's what I wanted, that the third person to give the reader that. I was trying to give the reader that feeling of someone, you're reading about someone who can't quite, it's all they can do to tell you about this at all, you know, and the only way, and they can't own up to it, they can't own it in the first person. And of course, as soon as he's released from the room, he can shift into the first person because he's taking possession of his life again, he's becoming active.
Yeah.
He's actually now able to do something about it, and he's sort of, although he's a different person to what he was when he went into the room, he's become himself again, you know, a version of himself.
One might argue, though, because, you know, Death of a Murderer is entirely in third person, you could also make that same sort of judgment call, because it's this capsule that doesn't have an opening or end, even though it does actually peer close into what's going on in his mind. So it's almost as if you create, again, more ambiguities, or what I was referring earlier.
Well, it's like a bubble, isn't it,
yeah.
Really? You're sort of, it should feel, the book should sort of feel sealed and kind of claustrophobic, I think. I mean, I wanted there to be a bit of that, despite the fact it's curious because you are in one room for the whole novel, but pretty much, and yet you're also in Italy, you're in France, you know, you travel quite a lot at the same time. So there's this, again, a juxtaposition of kind of, you know, the claustrophobia of the mortuary, but the kind of freedom of memory into which he's fleeing, I suppose, at certain points, although not to anything very comfortable.
I have a complex but somewhat quick question that may even be a bit reductive of your works, but I do want to at least pose it to you, and that is, I guess, the overall theme I could be convincingly argued of all of your works is generally some sort of misfit or misunderstood sort of person who is at the behest of some kind of societal constructs. Divided Kingdom, it's the character who just can't be, you know, pigeonholed in any of the four humors.
Yeah.
The Book of Revelation, likewise, it's someone who has a traumatic experience and then has difficulty adjusting for this very sort of reason you were describing in terms of him being actually removed.
Mm.
And that there is no sort of, I guess, you know, societal remedy to these problems. But here's the interesting thing about Death of a Murderer. It's that we actually have, I think, more so than these other books, there's more of an introspective quality to Billy's attempt to wrestle with this problem. Again, we were talking about the sergeant yesterday about him being this sort of moral force, this person looking out after it. Going back to this, to another thing we were talking about yesterday, which was you wanted to kind of slow down the process for the reader.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you likewise wanted to kind of expand the number of options and keep things more internal and less, and blaming the problems less so on the world as opposed to, you know, or societal constructs.
I differ slightly. I mean, it's interesting you see it that way, and I can sort of see that even with books like the Book of Revelation, societal constructs, you know, because when he takes his life in his hands, as it were, and goes to the police and tries to tell them about what's happened, they start laughing.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have anywhere to go, you know, basically. So I can see what you're saying, but I look at it more internally than that. I mean, I look at it from the point of view of, you know, I really don't like to look back too much over the body of work, and the terrible thing about having 7 or 8 books is if you do look back, you begin to see similarities, you know, and that sort of, that can cramp maybe what you do in the future if you're not careful. But what I have seen when I look back is a lot of the books seem to have one thing in common, which is they begin with trauma. They begin with a person's life, as you say, kind of being derailed, and they end at sort of exactly the point where a new beginning can take place. They kind of end at a beginning, you know, where, so in a curious way, most of these books are books that you can think about afterwards, that you can almost continue on in your mind, because those characters have just reached a point where they can begin to sort of live again, perhaps in some sort of a normal way, in a so-called normal way. So what I seem to be examining in the books is almost like a period of convalescence. And I seem to be looking at the convalescence or the adjustment that happens subsequent to trauma of some kind.
Yeah.
Now I have no idea where that is. I mean, but it seems a curious thing to be doing.
But the fact that we're talking about the policeman laughing and that there is no sort of societal remedy, these characters are very much left to kind of at least try to solve it themselves and cope with this really horrible.
But you see, it's universal. I mean, the thing I like about it is that yes, it may seem as if I'm focusing on something rather unusual, but everyone, I mean, pretty much everyone in their lives at some point is going to go through a process like this. It may be as something as simple as, you know, one of your parents dying, or it may be something more traumatic than that and less predictable. But I doubt there's anyone who hasn't gone through that kind of process. So in a sense, what I'm doing is that I'm examining something that's completely universal while still being somewhat left field.
But if you're not actually, you know, trying to sort of move away from your previous works, they're going to arrest us, don't worry.
They're coming for you.
Yeah, they're coming for me for these questions. No. There were actually many references in Death of a Murderer I found, or the allusions in a sort of perhaps, you know, unconscious, you know, subconscious way to your previous work. For example, the orange soda in the vending machine. And also the Orwell Estuary, which we haven't even touched upon, which reminded me, is this kind of like a... I kept thinking this was like a reference to Divided Kingdom, a sort of like...
I hadn't even thought of that. I mean, reality does kind of play tricks on you sometimes.
Yeah.
And I mean, once I decided the policeman had to come from Ipswich, the town of Ipswich, I knew he had to come from there because they drew policemen for that particular job of looking after the murderer's body. They drew them from a certain area of the country. So I knew he had to live in one of a certain number of towns.
Yeah.
And Ipswich seemed the obvious one and the most kind of... it was a place I didn't know at all. I had to go and explore.
Yeah.
And then once I had that, I needed... at the place that he goes to when he can't bear to go home.
Yeah.
And I just found this river estuary, you know, with laybys and with kind of, well, pretty much the people I describe in the book.
Yeah.
Strange loners hanging out there, you know, who would come and park, and there'd be a guy putting down poison for rats, there'd be a woman feeding the swans, there'd be all alone, though. And I talked to a few of them. I sort of engaged a few in the conversation, and the fact that it was called the Orwell Estuary, I never even occurred to me. I was simply looking for a kind of location, you know, and this was the perfect location. But, but you're right. And in fact, a Dutch publisher years ago started writing to me. He wasn't my Dutch publisher, but I knew him because I'd lived in Amsterdam a bit. And he started writing. Well, the first letter he wrote was about, which book was it? He said, "Do you always refer to your next novel? I mean, do you always have the title or the idea for your next novel in the current novel?" You know, because he'd noticed something like, in Soft, someone is described as a walking book of revelation.
Yeah.
And he'd noticed this. And you know, then the book of Revelation came out. And so that's the point that he wrote to me. And there was something, and I'm not going to remember what it is, but I've done it a couple of times since. Entirely unconsciously, but now I rather like the fact.
Yeah.
Planting the seed of the next one, you know.
I know Richard Yates did something like that, where he had a list of all the novels he wanted to write near the end of his life, you know, and he would have the titles there, and he actually stuck, I believe it's in Blake Bailey's biography of Richard Yates, but he actually stuck with many of these titles, so, you know, it's not...
I have titles for books I probably never will write. It's terrible that, having really wonderful titles, that you can't think you'll ever write that book. You don't even know necessarily what it'll be about, you know, I mean... Somehow it'd be really odd to start with the title.
Well, sure.
Never done that.
The other thing I wanted to mention about Billy is that his parents... I want to talk about sort of family structure in this book and in many of your other books, but I found it really interesting that his mother is a pharmacist. It's interesting now that you mentioned that he's in this state of convalescence. You have his mother being a pharmacist and his father is a jazz musician.
Yeah.
One involves caring and taking responsibility and, you know, really sort of... putting, I guess, the mothering, but also doping up as well, perhaps. There's the possibility
medicating,
of...
Medicating, yeah.
Yes, medicating. The other one involves, you know, I mean, his dad willfully flees responsibility in all this, and I was wondering, in terms of this family structure, did this come from the first draft, or was this kind of... When you were trying to figure out who Billy was, did this family structure... Did you feel the need that he needed to have a sort of, I guess, a clue as to why this kind of carrying one family structure to his new family structure?
Well, I knew there had to be some kind of a... there had to be both love and abandonment in his past. There had to be some kind of instability, because it wasn't so much a matter of, you know, I knew what kind of character he was, and I knew he was a kind of deliberate underachiever. There's a certain point earlier on in the novel where Phil Shaw, the detective sergeant, is saying to him, you know, you could have been a sergeant. You would have been a great sergeant.
Yeah. He was a natural, that's what
yes,
he says.
Yes, you're a natural, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And you sort of actually, you're supposed to feel as a reader, yeah, he could actually, because he's not, he's a cut above the average PC plod, you know, the guy on the street.
Yeah.
He feels like he's got more to him than that. And yet he's willfully not attempted to do it. You know, he's failed his sergeant exam once and he never takes it again and claims to be happy doing what he's doing. So, but I mean, clearly there's more to it than that. And I didn't want to kind of explain it or anything, but I wanted there to be certain kind of insecurity in his background that might contribute towards that kind of behavior, you know. As to whether that was all in the first draft, that's almost impossible for me to remember now.
Oh, yeah, well.
Because I mean, I never go back. I know I keep the first draft if I like, you know, I kept the first draft of Death and Murder because I liked it, even though, I mean, some first drafts can be very embarrassing, they can be awful.
Yeah.
But this wasn't a bad one, but, and I think, I'm sure the mother didn't have a job in the first draft, you know, and I'm, the father might not have even been there. Maybe there wasn't a father.
Yeah.
You know, he just simply wasn't mentioned. Maybe I didn't have the... Don't remember whether I had that strange reunion scene in the jazz club or not.
Yeah.
Which is a scene I really like, actually. I wouldn't mind using that in readings.
Yeah.
But no... where does that get us to?
Well, we were talking about family. Yeah. And also, this, I was going to lead this into a question about, like, again, the old world figures throughout this book, about how much Billy represents, you know, the kind of ironic new men, you know, which Newman is clearly an old world patriarchal figure. And, of course, you have, I was mentioning earlier about the misfits. George McGarry, the old man who appears late in the book, he says, there aren't people like me. And this, to me, is why, I constantly look at these, even these minor characters, and they seem to be this misunderstood misfits. That commingled with a more of a concern for patriarchal.
But that guy isn't a misfit. That guy sees himself, George McGarry sees himself as a special, unique. You know, that's why there aren't any people like him, because he's different.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's like a shipping magnate. Yeah. I mean, he's sort of. But as you see, it's weird because Billy, it seems to me that Billy actually in some way wants to be a kind of patriarch, a gentle patriarch, you know, because he's always trying to take care of people. I mean, he takes care of his mother. He takes care of, he kind of wants to take care of the Indian guy he meets, you know, in the small hours.
Yeah,
hospital cafe. There's someone else. Who is it?
But those in the present, like the hi-fi salesman and like his sergeant, seem to be having these terrible sort of personal problems involving their families. Their wife. In the case of the hi-fi salesman, he's like there in the hospital tending after his wife. And in Phil Shaw's case, he's you know, recovering from this
divorce.
You want
me to write a novel about happy people?
Well, true. No, but I'm wondering why you don't have at least one sort of, I guess, character who's doing all right. I mean, you know, not that I'm asking you.
Isn't there anyone who's doing all right? Let me see. In that. In Death of a Murderer, maybe there isn't.
If you're doing all right, you become a vicious bastard who's taking, you know... oh, that's one other thing about Newman we didn't even talk about. The Thai prostitute casino worker.
Oh, that's the other person who Billy takes care of.
Yeah, yeah.
He's very tender with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's not really supposed to be a prostitute. She's
supposed to be
in that grey area.
Yeah.
You know, of girls who are attractive who might go with someone because they've got money. And then find themselves in situations they can't get out of, you know, a little bit out of their depth.
Again, going back to this noir idea, which I was suggesting, you know?
Going back to which?
This idea of noir symbols throughout
your work. Yes, yeah. I guess that, I fess up to that one. that's a little bit clear, you know, because I have a casino. In The Insult, there's a woman I really like who works in a casino. There's a character, Karen, I think. I am drawn to all that, I suppose. You know, some of my favorite movies were in that genre. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk again about the comparison between Billy Dodds from Soft and... Barker Dodds from Soft and Billy Tyler. Dodds, very much like Billy, can't seem to escape his past. And with Billy, there is, I guess, some possibility of redemption.
He's a bit freer. He's a little... I mean, he's a bit more unentangled, Billy, isn't he?
Yeah.
Than Barker. I mean, Barker's caught up in a kind of a mess that's partly of his own making, but it's sort of he. Funnily enough, I think he has sort of less to him.
Yeah.
There's a peculiar. I don't know why I feel that.
But he's also more trapped too. It's also because it's interesting to me because Barker comes from a prison background of some sort, and you know he's fleeing the police, and then Billy is actually the police.
Yes, so he's supposed to be the other side of the coin.
Yeah, and I was curious. I mean, you say you don't look back at your novels, but clearly there is something of an inverted character type that you're pursuing in another sort of form here.
Right? I'm not aware of that. I'm simply aware. I think when I embark on something new, I'm simply aware that this is going to present a different challenge to any other book. Mm-hmm. So it's curious, you know, I'm not thinking, now, is this going to have noir elements in it? Or is this going to be, you know, are the characters going to be like this? I usually don't know much about the characters when I start.
Yeah.
I just launch in and they sort of, they gradually emerge and develop. But it's much more about, you know, the kind of challenge would be a kind of... A prose style that I'd never done before, like you know, like the fact that this had to be. This were two big challenges actually. Death of a Murderer. I mean, partly the thing was placing a fiction into fact,
yeah,
in a kind of seamless way, so that they bonded perfectly. And I mean, like a beautiful ring. I wanted it to be like that.
Yeah.
So the setting had to be authentic and solid, and then the fiction set in like a stone, you know, that just stayed there and sat there, and the two things worked together so that nobody thought about them as separate elements. You know, that was always going to be a huge challenge with this book in all kinds of ways. And then simply whether I could be disciplined enough to strip the language down to nothing, whether I could still get a buzz out of sentences when they were as plain as they possibly could be, you know. And it's funny, there's a sentence in, my favorite sentence in the Book of Revelation. So clearly as far back as, you know, like 99, 2000, I was thinking in this way. My favorite sentence in that book was when the dancer is freed from the room and he finds himself in Brazil, I think.
Yeah.
In a club, and he's dancing for probably the first time. I mean, dancing in a club, not dancing professionally. And he... he says that he's describing what it feels like to be dancing in this hot, humid air. Says something like, it felt like my body felt as if it was made of one pure thing. I mean, that's not a perfect quotation, but it's a very simple sentence, but there's a whole idea in there. And I mean, the words couldn't be more simple in themselves, but the thought is quite complex, you know, and I feel as if that's the way I'm going. I mean, that's what I'm really interested in now, and that's why the idea of doing a memoir next is going to be so intriguing, because it's almost as if, in some sense, the Death of a Murderer was a rehearsal for that.
You're moving closer to fact.
Well, yeah, and memory, you know, and how you structure memory, and which was the other huge challenge of Death of a Murderer, like trying to put together a book like that, which is almost 100% flashback, but there's six or seven stories. They're all being remembered in different orders and different, even within themselves.
Yeah.
So enough to drive you mad on some days, actually.
Yeah. Just like well, anyway, I thank you so much for taking the time out while you're in New York during a fleeting period to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks
very much,
Ed,
for your time.
Thanks for having
really
me.
Thanks.
Yourself in a living room.